Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon. Great pleasure to be here in Adelaide to talk about the road to recovery. The global economy, as you know, is in recession. Virtually all of Australia's trading partners are contracting. In fact, almost every country with which we would normally make comparisons is in recession, and for many of them it's a bad one. It's very rare for Australia to escape an international downturn, and there's no precedent for us escaping altogether one of this magnitude. We, like other countries, have trade and financial linkages to the rest of the world. We're all ourselves personally, of course, aware of what happens abroad, and our own expectations and behaviour can hardly but help but be affected by what we see there. Whether or not the next GDP statistic, which is due in early June, shows a further contraction, I think the reasonable person, looking at all the information that we have available now, would come to the conclusion that Australia too is in recession. These are periods of hardship for significant parts of the community. People lose jobs, businesses fail, loans go bad, plans are unfulfilled, and so such episodes are to be avoided if that's possible, and at least ameliorated when they occur. It's for that reason, among others, that most countries today have extensive social safety nets so that when recessions do happen, we can avoid the extent of outright misery that used to be seen in such episodes earlier in history. Policymakers, of course, also seek to cushion downturns with the use of macroeconomic policies. Usually they're more successful in doing that if they've had some success in restraining the preceding boom. But no country's policymakers have succeeded in abolishing the business cycle, much as they've all tried. Cyclical behaviour has always been a feature of market economies. It always will be. So if you should see at some time in the future a claim to the contrary, a claim that this time is different, and you will see that sooner or later, it would be advisable to treat that with great scepticism, and in fact, probably it would be advisable to treat it as an indication that a cyclical turning point is close to happening. Most of the time, economic activity expands. Population grows, people get wealthier, they aspire to live better, and so demand increases. And on the supply side, workforces rise because of population growth. Innovation and productivity growth and investment push up supply capacity. And that's the normal state of affairs for an economy, or at least one like ours. But every so often, on average about every 7 or 8 years, but not quite so regularly that it can be well forecast, a set of conditions arise that sees demand weaken for a while, output goes down, unemployment rises, and that's a recession. Usually, though not always, inflation also falls in that scenario. Modern Australia has experienced a number of recessions. In the early 1950s, the early 60s, the early 70s, or the mid-70s, the early 80s, the early 90s, now in 2008-09. There were also events that I think reasonably could be labelled brief recessions in 1957 and 1977. So on that count, this is actually the eighth such episode since World War II. Most of these events have been correlated highly with international business cycles. There were significant mid-cycle slowdowns in growth, which did not develop fully into recessions, in the mid-60s, the very early 70s, the mid-80s, the mid-90s, and in 2000, 2001. And each of those episodes, output slowed or even declined briefly. Unemployment stopped falling and rose, and inflation went down. By the way, if you insist on using the two negative quarter definition of recession, which I don't think is a good one, but if you do use that, there was a recession in 1965. Anybody here remember that? It isn't remembered that way, and that I think shows that. And there was also another one in the early 70s on the same criteria. They're not remembered that way because they weren't really recessions, which I think illustrates that that particular definition has some flaws. The 2001 episode was notable because it coincided with a downturn in the major countries. It was unusual for Australia not to have a recession when that happens, though as it was, the rate of unemployment did rise by about a percentage point over the space of a year. One of the things that helped us on that occasion was that the downturn in the major countries wasn't very deep, and also that a number of our other trading partners, particularly China, continued to grow quite well. This time around, the global economy is in much worse shape than it was then. The extent of the recent weakness was largely unexpected. Until the financial crisis erupted and got so much worse in the way it did last September, it appeared that, yes, some of the major countries were having downturns, but that much of the emerging world, including Asia, would slow, but not by as much as on other occasions. They were affected by the weaker demand from the developed world, but there was, I think, the thought that those countries did not have themselves the financial problems that were at the heart of the crisis, and they didn't seem to have some of the problems that they had themselves had had in previous episodes. So it was expected they would slow, but not slump. Now, that wasn't really so-called decoupling, simply the assessment that the net of a range of competing forces would produce a significant slowdown, but not a slump. So at that point, global growth was expected to slow to below average, having been well above average and, in fact, unsustainably high for several years. Then, as you know, in September, things took a serious turn for the worse. The financial turmoil following the Lehman collapse was the most intense in generations. The financial turmoil itself was actually contained in about 6 weeks or so. And I would say, in fact, over the past few months, that conditions in financial markets generally have been gradually improving. But what we're seeing now is the fallout in the rest of the economy from the response to that earlier turmoil. The weakened ability of financial institutions to provide credit to the rest of the economy is certainly one factor at work, and many people have said that. But I think a bigger factor than that is the decline in confidence and the sudden and widespread aversion to risk among firms, ordinary industrial firms and households all over the world. It seems that everybody everywhere, watching CNN and seeing all those events in September and October, and consequently feeling poorer because their wealth had declined and fearing bad times ahead, simultaneously decided to pull back their own spending, curtail their investment and expansion plans, and reduce their debt. Now, actually, at the individual level, it was entirely rational for people to feel more risk-averse and to behave in a more precautionary way. But the collective sum of those decisions created over the ensuing 6 months, an international slump in demand for consumer durables and investment goods that was sharper and more synchronised across countries than anything seen for many decades. The result of that is that the world's gross product is now thought likely to decline in 2009, the first time that's happened since at least the Second World War. Australians too shared in this more cautious behaviour, particularly in the business world. A range of business surveys suggest that a trend moderation in business confidence that had been occurring for some time turned abruptly much weaker in October, weakened further in November and stayed weak thereafter, though there has been some recovery in some of those indicators in March of this year. Household confidence is a slightly different story, and I'm going to come to that shortly. But certainly there was a big decline in business confidence. The official data don't yet show it, but it is likely that business investment spending is in the process of declining very sharply. Hiring intentions, of course, have been cut back quite quickly. Residential investment has also been falling, and exports, not surprisingly, have also declined. The net result of that is that the Australian economy has been contracting for a little while now. Though, on the best information we have, not at the pace seen in some other countries, where quarterly declines in real GDP of 3 or 4 or even 5% in a quarter occurred in the last quarter of last year and probably again in the March quarter of 2009. Now, a key dimension through which Australia experiences changing global conditions is via the terms of trade. And you can think of our terms of trade, or the ratio of export to import prices, as a gauge of the income gains or losses that international relative price movements impart to the Australian economy. When our export prices rise relative to import prices, our real purchasing power goes up. And vice versa when they fall. Over the 5 years to 2008, which was a period of exceptionally strong growth in the world economy, Australia's terms of trade rose by 60%, equivalent to about 12% of a year's GDP. That's $140 billion in annual additional income. It was the biggest such gain in half a century, the previous one having been the Korean War boom in the early 1950s. Now the terms of trade have fallen, reversing part, though so far only part, of that earlier gain. Let me make a couple of points about these terms of trade swings that I think are quite important. Firstly, in earlier episodes, those terms of trade fluctuations seriously destabilised the economy. In the early 50s, in the mid-70s and late 70s, terms of trade movements were very destabilising to the macro economy. On this occasion, certainly there have been significant adjustment issues, which mainly come under the heading of the two-speed economy, so-called, as resource-intensive areas grow faster and other areas grow slower. But for all that, on this occasion, a floating exchange rate, a much more flexible labour market, and better macroeconomic policy frameworks, among other things, have helped the economy adapt to the terms of trade swings without the degree of instability we saw in the past. And I think that's a success of the arrangements in place. The second point to make is that at this stage, the fall in the terms of trade that is occurring does not seem to be reversing all of the previous rise. It's true that prices for bulk commodities are currently being renegotiated lower. But when we put all that through, we may well still find, I think, that at the end of the year, Australia's terms of trade will be still some 40% higher than the average for the period 1980 to 2000. That's a very big gain. Now, maybe that won't persist. Maybe commodity prices will fall further in the years ahead. But alternatively, maybe what these markets are telling us is that some factors beneficial to Australia, foremost among them the continued likely emergence of China, remain in place. And it's probably not entirely coincidental that the clearest signs of an upward turning point in economic activity around the world are accumulating in China, though not exclusively there. Well, that's a description of where we are and some of the background as to how we got here and some perspective on how to think about it. I don't want to talk today about the financial excesses that helped create this situation. That's been talked about in great detail in the past. What I want to do instead is to devote some attention to the question, how do we get out of here? How do we get on the road to recovery? History shows that recessions come, but also that they end. Can we speed that process? And to the extent that we have any capacity to shape the new expansion, which will eventually get underway, how might we use that capacity? Well, this is essentially an international episode, so much depends, as always, on what happens abroad. That doesn't mean that we're helpless to affect our own future here, and it doesn't relieve us of the responsibility to do sensible things to promote our own recovery. So I'll come to some of that in a minute, but let me talk a little bit about what's needed for a durable global upswing. I'm going to take it as given that we all agree that a better international financial regulatory framework is needed. There's a lot of work underway on that. And in fact, one growth industry is the number of international working groups and meetings that are taking place in the official world. So that's, I think, to be taken as given, but that's about avoiding a repeat of this crisis, which we've got to do, but how do we get out of this crisis in the meantime? Well, I think there are several key elements. The first is, as many people have said, is to sort out the mess in the financial system itself, especially in the US, the UK, and some parts of Europe. It's not an easy problem to solve, but quite a lot is known, actually, about how to do this from the experience of past episodes, including in the United States itself. The first step, and this sounds easy, but it's very important, the first step is an honest accounting of how big the problems are. Once that's established, the next step is the legacy assets, as we now call them, rather than toxic, have to be quarantined so that the potential for further erosion of their quality and therefore uncertainty over their value doesn't lead to further loss of confidence in banks and the erosion of banks' capital. The relevant institutions, that is the banks, must then be recapitalized if need be so that, freed of the problem loans, they can get back to normal business, that is, lending to normal commercial risks. Now, it may be that once they are appropriately cleaned up, these banks can attract new private capital, in which case, great. If not, then public funds have to be made available to recapitalize them as needed. Everybody understands those principles. The question really is how to implement them, and there's a few ways you can go about doing that, and actually we see all of these three approaches I'm going to outline being used in various countries. One approach is to hive off the bad assets into a so-called bad bank or an asset management vehicle of some kind. Separate then the good bank and it goes on its way, and then you manage the bad bank and gradually wind it down. Of course, to do that, you have to transfer those assets at some price. That's the tricky part, because the pricing of those asset transfers has to protect the taxpayer, because the taxpayer should not overpay and therefore thereby give a windfall to the shareholders of the troubled banks. At the same time as you're doing this, though, there has to be some pressure on the financial institutions actually to get on with the cleanup and not just wait around for something to turn up, which is a temptation. The plan being implemented in the US has the additional element that it's trying to induce private capital to come in and take part in these asset management vehicles, which actually will help, I think, in sorting out the pricing issue. So that's one approach. Another approach is you leave these assets on the bank's balance sheets, but you offer insurance on further falls in their value at public expense for a fee. You don't do that for free, you put a price on it, and that's basically what's happening in the UK. A third approach, and probably the more traditional one, is to nationalise the relevant institutions, which of course obviates the issue of what price you pay for the assets. It just introduces the price of the question of what price you pay for the shares. But it does at least provide enough capital and provide a basis for getting back to a sustainable financial system. That's tended to be the traditional approach, though it's mostly been used in smaller countries, or when it's used in big countries only for smaller institutions historically. So there are not so many precedents for nationalising major banks in major countries. Well, the economics of all those approaches is basically the same. It's about recognising losses that have occurred, reducing the riskiness of bank balance sheets, and finding new capital to enable them to start the credit process running again. Which technique you use is really a matter of judgment in the case concerned. I think we've probably got to recognise too that the politics of all this may well be harder than the economics of it. Ordinary people resent, and it isn't surprising, they resent taxpayer funds being used to fix problems that arose at least partly because there were seriously misaligned incentives that rewarded financiers for taking too much risk. It's unpopular and it's expensive, but it has to be done, otherwise the financial systems and economies concerned suffer for much longer. So the political leaderships of the US and the UK and some other countries have the unenviable task of trying to get their citizens to accept the need for these sorts of measures. So that's one requirement for recovery internationally. You've got to fix the financial system. A second condition is macroeconomic support for aggregate demand in a world where private demand has slumped owing to the loss of confidence and the strains in credit markets. Now that support is coming into place as a result of monetary policy easing and easing in fiscal policy in many countries. Internationally, the role of fiscal policy is much more prominent in this episode than it's been for quite a while, because the impaired credit systems in many countries make monetary policy less effective than it usually would be. The reason official interest rates are approaching zero in a growing list of countries isn't because central banks think it's a great idea to give credit for free. It's because the flow through from the official rate to the rates that matter, namely the ones that borrowers actually pay, that flow-through hasn't been working very well in some of those countries. So there's macroeconomic expansion to support demand. A third requirement that will need to accompany both the financial sector rescues and the macroeconomic policy easing, there's a third requirement that's more medium-term, and that comes under the heading of exit strategies. In those countries where governments end up owning part or all of their banks, there will need to be a plan to divest that holding at the appropriate time when conditions improve. It's not the time yet, but that time will come, and there'll need to be a plan to do that. The same can be said, I think, of the various guarantees under which banks globally, everywhere, are raising money at present. That was a very important step to enable the system to get through a period of severe dislocation. But surely it's not desirable as a permanent state of affairs. At some point it will be prudent to start weaning banks, and more particularly investors, off those guarantees. Perhaps coordinating a departure from the guarantees across countries would be a useful role for the newly reconstituted Financial Stability Board, which is the successor to the Financial Stability Forum, an international body for cooperating on stability and regulatory matters. The other international exit strategy, of course, will be on macroeconomic policies. The size of the downturn, the extent of the fiscal stimulus, and the cost of the financial restructuring packages have placed a very large burden on government finances in a number of countries. Now, I'm not arguing against the measures that were taken, but they will need to be accompanied by a credible story about how governments are going to keep their own finances on a sustainable footing in the long run. Taxpayers, markets, and creditors will lose rather than gain confidence if they can't see that path back to stability. And of course, at this point, what this is all about is confidence. The same issues, of course, will arise for the exceptional monetary policy measures that are being undertaken in some countries, and I'm sure that my counterparts abroad are highly aware of that issue. The fourth condition for a durable international expansion is to avoid perpetuating what have come to be known as the global imbalances. The excess of saving over investment in much of the emerging world, and especially in Asia, was one part of the story, only one part, but nonetheless a part of the story of how the search for yield ended up leading to a lot of excessive risk-taking. Now, that isn't to blame Asia for the crisis at all, but it states the obvious, which is if you've had people in one part of the world misusing inexpensive and abundant capital, the capital had to be abundant in the first place for that to occur. And as it's turned out, there was more capital available more cheaply than the US and other developed countries were able to use sensibly. So to the extent that strong global growth in recent years or earlier years relied on advanced country consumers lowering their saving, absorbing the export surpluses of the developing world, and accepting higher debt burdens in the process, well, that model is broken. Of course, the most important thing is for the US economy to start growing again as soon as possible. But even when it does, and when other troubled economies start growing again, the reality is that for some time ahead, developed world consumers are going to want to save more of their income and reduce their debts. They're not going to be the same spur to consumption globally as they used to be. That will mean that global growth will be, at least for a little while, somewhat lower on average than we were used to until recently. How much lower will depend on the extent to which the economies in the emerging world are able to accommodate stronger domestic demand. And there's some issues involved in them doing that. One of them is that for them to feel safe in growing faster at home and perhaps in returning to their more customary position of being capital importers rather than capital exporters, they will need to be confident that the rules of international engagement are not skewed unfairly towards the advanced world. In the end, though, one way or another, durable growth is going to have to be more balanced growth than the growth we had in the past decade. To all of that, I should add that maintaining openness to trade and capital flows is key. Now, that shouldn't really need to be said. We all really understand that. But in times of serious recession, there are often times when protectionist sentiments take root. So it's important, I think, to keep in mind the need for that openness to be maintained. Well, I don't want to say any more now about conditions for global recovery. Let me turn closer to home. Australians, of course, cannot do a great deal to make these global conditions for growth come about. What we can do is maximise our chances of benefiting from an international expansion when it begins. And I think, and I've said this before, but it's important, the first thing is to maintain some confidence in ourselves and in our prospects over time. We cannot achieve effortless prosperity on the back of ever-rising mineral prices, and we can't achieve effortless prosperity on the back of just bidding up the prices of our houses. And it's important we recognise that. But as I've said before, Australia's genuine long-term prospects remain good. And there are still, I think, good grounds to think that we will come through the storm better than most. It's noteworthy, in fact, that measures of household confidence taken from surveys show that in Australia, while confidence has declined relative to the ebullient levels of early 2008, it is much more resilient to date than corresponding measures for many other countries. Households do expect unemployment to be much higher a year from now than it is. But their stated expectations about economic conditions 5 years from now have barely changed at all from what we've seen over recent years. And in the printed version of the talk, there's a couple of charts there that illustrate that. So notwithstanding their evident caution just now, people remain essentially optimistic about the long term. Consumer demand in Australia, while certainly weak compared with the run of recent years, is actually at the stronger end of international comparisons among advanced countries. No doubt that owes something to fiscal stimulus, to lower interest rates, but maybe it also shows the inherently optimistic view that Australians take in the future. That optimism, provided it's combined, as I think it is, with a sensible appreciation of risk, is a fundamental strength. It's to be hoped that over the period ahead, that will be matched by some recovery in business confidence. And that remains to be seen, although there have been, as I said earlier, one or two encouraging signs just lately in that area. What can policymakers do to help this process? Well, there isn't in my office or anyone else's a lever labelled confidence that you can just grab hold of and pull. So our task is rather one of trying to behave across the board in ways which will enhance rather than erode confidence. In the past 6 months, that's involved being prepared to deploy macroeconomic policy measures very quickly and quite aggressively, both fiscal and monetary. And the effects of those measures will be coming through, particularly the monetary ones, for quite some time yet. Measures to sustain confidence in the financial sector, like the guarantees and so on, and other things that were done to help key markets function were also important in helping confidence. But maybe there's also some value in articulating a longer run picture of where we want to get to when the international cyclical downturn ends, as it will, and recovery takes hold. What kind of country economically does Australia want to be during the next expansion? How do we want to be positioned in the global marketplace for capital, bearing in mind that that market will have absorbed a great deal of government debt over the next several years around the world, and we'll be evaluating opportunities for other private uses of capital? Well, I think that we have a very good chance of offering a setting, an economic setting, in which six important conditions will hold. Let me tell you what they are. Firstly, political stability remains assured. That's actually getting a bit less common in the world than it once was. Secondly, in Australia, the government doesn't own and hasn't had to give overt financial support to banks. there are going to be some very difficult governance and exit strategy issues arising in a number of countries in this area. Australia is going to be free of those. Thirdly, public finances will remain in very good shape. There will be some debt, yes, but modest compared to what we will see around the world. And there will, I think, be a medium-term path that we can articulate for the federal budget back towards balance over time. We don't have the massive obligations arising from bank rescues and so on that are pushing budget deficits to 10% of GDP or more in some countries. Those burdens are going to seriously constrain the room for manoeuvre those countries have fiscally in the years ahead. Australia is going to be free, largely, of such constraints. Fourthly, sensible policy frameworks, fiscal, monetary, macroeconomic and microeconomic, remain in place, and I think will remain in place. The financial regulatory system here is well-based and it's strong and well-tested. So that's an advantage. Fifthly, we remain open for business. Australia remains open, and I trust will remain open, to trade and investment. We have a capacity to deploy our own capital and other people's capital prudently and profitably. And finally, there's an exposure to, and if we are sensible, a willingness to engage with, an Asian region where for decades ahead hundreds of millions of people are going to be seeking better living standards and providing opportunities for business. Well, there are few countries, I suspect, that have the potential to offer that prospect, that proposition, either to international capital or to its own citizens. It's a proposition that if we pursue it sensibly and consistently, will provide us with the most secure basis for confidence in Australia's future. And it's that confidence, more than anything else, which will drive us along the road to recovery. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Glenn. It's Julian Robertson from Department of Treasury and Finance in South Australia. Do you see any risk of stagflation moving forward, given that the government's decided to stimulate a sector of the economy which has existing skill shortages on the labour side of the equation?
I don't think myself that stagflation, the combination of stagnation in economic activity and high inflation at the same time, I doubt that's what's in prospect internationally. I know that there's, in some quarters, reservations expressed about some of the unconventional monetary policy measures that have been done in some countries, not here but elsewhere. And there will be an exit issue for those central banks when the time comes, but I think what they're seeking to do is to make sure they don't have a deflation in prices, it'll be a matter of calibrating their responses to make sure that they steer the right middle path. In Australia, I don't have any particular comments to make about the various fiscal measures that have been undertaken. At times like this, you do what stimulus measures can reasonably be done, and that's, I think, what our government and ourselves are seeking to do. I think the big picture over the next couple of years is inflation's likely to be declining, which, you know, it's coming from a point that was way too high, so some decline actually is good. But I think that the trend is more likely to be down than up, even if there are some pockets of pressure, as you suggest.
Christine Locker from Locker Christine. Human Resources. I've got a double-barreled question, if that's okay. Firstly, you mentioned a couple of positive signs in business, and I'd be interested to know whether you can share what they are that you've seen of recent. And secondly, what's India's position in our recovery? Obviously, that's one of the big growth markets, but there's little that we've, well, certainly I've heard about how that may play a role for Australia's recovery.
It's probably remiss of me not to, to mention India more than I do, because they will in due course be quite a large economy, and they've certainly had a very impressive growth performance over recent years. At this point, the Indian economy is still a fair bit smaller than China, and China's growth has probably, on the whole, been even faster than India's, so hence the prominence that we perhaps give to China. But you're quite right, India is going to be a very important global economy over the long run, and different sort of place to China. It has different comparative advantages, but I'm sure there are plenty of opportunities for Australia in a business sense there. What are the encouraging signs? Well, there is, I think, the one of the leading business surveys showed a pickup in the measure of business confidence in March, which was quite pronounced, though it's still at a low level. Now, I'm not trying to say that happy days are here again as a result just of that, but, you know, I think some stabilisation and pickup there would be welcome. Around the world, we see, I think, in a number of countries, some signs that the rate of contraction may be abating, and I think we see quite clear signs that the rate of growth in China is picking up. That's across a whole range of their indicators. I don't think there's actually much question that that's occurring now. The question will be how durable that turns out to be, and I can't judge that at the moment, but certainly there are those indications, and even in some of the major countries, things not quite so dire as they were, though hardly good at this point.
Michael Smith from Channel 9, if you can hear me or not. This is a two-part question as well. First of all, how frustrated do you get when the retail banks fail to pass on in full any cuts in the official cash rate? And secondly, given that you've confirmed today that we are in a recession, what are the chances of another interest rate cut next month?
Well, since you ask a two-barrel question, I can pick which barrel to answer, I suppose. I think I won't bite too much at whether it's frustrating observing the pass-through issue, but I think we should keep some perspective here. Since last August, the cash rate's fallen 425 points. Mortgage rates have fallen not quite that much, but not all that far short of that. That's a very big decline. And mortgage rates are now very low. And it's not surprising that borrowing for housing is starting to pick up quite noticeably, and I think we'll continue to see that. And I think in the broader discussion about these pass-through issues, we ought to just keep some focus on that broader picture. And I have no comment about future meetings, obviously.